Nellis Air Force Base is known as the home of the fighter pilot, but it's so much more than that. It is truly the beating heart of the United States Air Force. For 80 years, Nellis has been home to some of the most beloved and important units and events in Air Force history. Over the next couple of months, I will dive deep into the history, units, people, and stories that make Nellis Air Force Base special. For this introductory episode, I brought back Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry to help me lay out the importance of this base to aviation history and preview this upcoming season. This is the Air Minded Podcast, Nellis Season. Welcome back, Air Minded listeners. It has been far too long. I am your host, the Air Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel. Very happy to be back to doing this podcast again. As I've repeatedly mentioned over the last few months, I was just finishing this summer my 2-year stint as commander of the 32nd Intelligence Squadron, and leading a squadron of more than 400 airmen and guardians can be very time-consuming, and as much as I wanted to get to this podcast, I had my day job to do that took just too much time for me to be able to give this podcast the kind of effort that I really wanted to. But now I've got all kinds of time, I am out of command, and I'm back at it, and very excited about the upcoming guests and the Nellis season that we're going to be talking about for the next few episodes. From the beginning of the idea for this podcast, one of the things that I wrote down as the in my first kind of ideas book, if you will, was I wanted to do a season dedicated to Nellis Air Force Base. If you include my time as a student and instructor at the Air Force Weapons School, I've spent more than 4 years assigned in Nellis, and by a fairly conservative estimate, I'd say I'd spent at least another year of temporary duty at Nellis doing exercises, conferences, test events, etc. Nellis is home to the Air Force's operational test, training, and tactics development. It is the epicenter of joint and combined air, space, and cyberspace warfare, training, and tactics development. There is simply no other military installation in the world like it. It is an exciting and historical place. In this first episode of this upcoming season, I want to provide the roadmap for what we're going to discuss over the next couple of months. I asked my really good friend and mentor, Slam Gentry, to help me set the table for this season. You probably remember Slam from the Desert Storm intro episode that we split into two parts. People seem to enjoy the banter that Slam and I have. I guess that's built over a decade of friendship, actually closing in on 15 years now. Slam's love and reverence for Nellis comes out very clearly in our conversation. I didn't think anybody could love Nellis more than I do, but he certainly gives me a run for my money. Just a couple of notes on this episode. Slam knows me from well before my call sign was changed to Gorilla. He knows me as Getter, so he'll refer to me a couple of times as Getter. So if you hear that, that's who he's talking about. Also, hidden in the episode, Tyson Jr. wakes up from a nap at a certain point and starts crying. I tried to edit around that, but if you hear something just a little bit odd, that's probably my less than 2-year-old son waking up. And then finally, for some reason, I started using the word, and then Slam started using the word when he heard it. The word ethos is mentioned a ton of times. So if you're so inclined to play a drinking game, take a shot of Jeremiah Wheat every time you hear either Slam or I say the word ethos. Just make sure you don't have anything planned for the rest of the day. So with that said, I really appreciate you tuning in and listening to the Air Minded Podcast. It's been great to get back into it. I'm really excited about not only this episode, but the episodes to come over the next couple of months. So with that said, let me get on to the interview or to the conversation I have with Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry. Welcome, listeners, to the first Air Minded Podcast season, where we're going to be taking a look at Nellis Air Force Base, what I like to call the beating heart of the United States Air Force. Over the next couple of months, we'll be talking about the importance of Nellis to the Air Force, the history of the base, the events, the aircraft, people, and stories that make Nellis special. I'm going to have numerous special guests over these episodes, including Air Force senior leaders, tacticians, historians. What ties them all together is that they've studied or they've spent significant time at Nellis, and they all love what Nellis means to the service. My first guest, I told you they would be senior leaders, tacticians, or historians, all eminent in their field, except for this one. This is my first repeat guest, Lieutenant Colonel Chris Slam Gentry. Sorry for the backhanded compliment. You may remember him from joining me in the Intro Desert Storm podcast, where we talked a little bit about what is important to us in Desert Storm. We're going to do the same thing for Nellis.
Slam is a recent graduate of the Naval War College, so he needs a little bit of re-bluing to get back from his naval roots there, get back to his Air Force roots, if you will. He is also a graduate, I believe, in 2003, as I recall, from the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, which makes him old. And he spent uncountable months there for conferences, red flag exercises, weapon school events, I'm sure a ton of other reasons. Slam is also responsible for my love of Nellis. He inspired me to go to weapon school. And when he was my first boss in the United States Air Force, he sent me out to work on a major weapon school exercise as a still wet behind the ears second lieutenant. He assigned me to the world famous 58th Fighter Squadron Mighty Gorillas, which led to a couple of my first red flag experiences. So with that intro said, welcome Slam Gentry, the first two-time guest. How does it feel?
Oh, dude, it is such an honor. Totally accurate to sort of sum it up that I'm not a historian. I've never flown an airplane. I'm not particularly an expert in any particular field, but I am flattered that for some reason you've had me back for a second time.
Well, hopefully, you know, we will repeat the magic of the first Desert Storm podcast, which people seem to like, playing off of each other and talking a little bit about some history that we both really, really like. You just took a sip that I saw there. So let's go ahead and start. A couple of these episodes I've actually forgotten to ask. So let's start with what you're drinking. I think you're going to have a little bit of an explanation. So I will simply say I'm having a Devil's Backbone Vienna Lager is what I'm going with today. What do you have for today's special episode?
Mine's a bit more complicated. I don't drink these usually when I'm not at Nellis Air Force Base, but I made an exception for today's episode. This is a Peterson. It's good for the soul. A Peterson is two parts gin, two parts vodka, one part dry vermouth, a splash of rainwater, all on the rocks with a threefer of cocktail onions. And that comes from one of the many Pete Petersons that's a legend on Nellis Air Force Base. The late Pete Peterson that was the founder, originator of this drink, passed away about a decade ago. And he used to always joke with me when I was a weapons undergraduate or a WUG at Nellis that I'm the 69th most important Pete Peterson to ever be at Nellis Air Force Base. And Pete was an old Korea and Vietnam vet, F-86 pilot, amongst other platforms. But he used to joke about, hey, Pete Peterson is the most important or the most proliferated call sign across Air Force history. And let me give you just three examples of that. One, going back historically, Chelsea Pete Peterson was one of the youngest aces of World War II, the youngest 06 within the Army Air Corps at age 23. He was the commander of the 4th Fighter Group during World War II in his early to mid-20s, an extraordinary young airman. Joseph Pete Peterson was, I believe, the third African-American member of the Thunderbirds, and he was part of that absolutely tragic crash near Indian Springs in 1982, where he lost all four Thunderbird pilots in a crash, an absolutely tragic event that I'm sure we'll talk about later in the Thunderbirds episode as we examine that part of Nellis history. And then Douglas Pete Peterson shot down over North Vietnam in 1966, prisoner of war in Hanoi for over 6 years, went back in 1997 as the first ambassador in the post-Vietnam era, in the Clinton administration, going back to the land of the enemy, as was sort of the narrative of the time. So three extraordinary Pete Petersons, and each of them have ties to Nellis Air Force Base, kind of linking it back to the theme of this series of the Air Minded podcast.
Wow. Did not think that you would be able to tie in your beverage today into Nellis, but this is why we have you. Really appreciate that. You know, the other easy one would have been Jeremiah Weed, which is standard initially at the Nellis Officers Club and now throughout the Air Force. And maybe we either in this episode or a future one, we can talk about why we drink Jeremiah Weed, that god awful, awful stuff. Either in this episode or a future episode, but I'm very happy that neither of us are drinking Jeremiah Weed right now. You need to be in the right frame of mind. It's a little early in the day for me to get after the Jeremiah Weed. So we usually, I usually ask about your kind of Air Force or air-minded origin story. You've been with us once before. So instead of just your overall origin story, why don't you tell us your Nellis origin story? I mentioned at the beginning, 2003 graduate of the Weapons School. How did you get there? What is the origin for your time at Nellis?
My first operational assignment was not in the fighter world. It was in the special operations world. At the time, the 352nd Special Operations Group at RAF Mildenhall. But I had an NCO who was a mentor and a great trainer of mine named Dwayne Douglas. He was a tech sergeant at the time, and he was a graduate of the 33rd Fighter Wing, if you will. He was at the 33rd when the great Shane Toop Hamilton was the intel weapons officer there in the late 1990s. And he's the one who encouraged me, one, to embrace the Air Warfare Center, Nellis writ large, and just go out to all the various sort of training events, whether it be a flag. My first experience was the Integrated Air Defense Systems, or IADS, Forum in 2002 with Dwayne. And, that experience is the one that really motivated me to apply for the weapons school the next year in 2003. When you go up to Nellis Air Force Base, it has a different feel than any Air Force base, and I would submit to you, Getter, than any other military base in the DOD. When you roll into Nellis, it is a beautiful mix of tactical heritage and just a little bit of sort of tactical danger that you don't get at any other military installation. You can see the Las Vegas Strip in the distance. You see the mountains and the Nellis Range off to the other direction, off to the northwest. And that's just a very special feeling every time you go to Nellis. And I certainly got that feeling when I first went there in 2002.
Yeah, you definitely even feel it as you drive up. First off, there's just an excitement about going TDY or temporary assignment to Nellis. You know you're going out to Las Vegas. You know it's going to be a good time. And then the first time you drive into the base, you see the sign, Home of the Fighter Pilot. And we'll talk about that. Because I would contend we actually don't do ourselves justice when we say it's just Home of the Fighter Pilot, but that is an ethos that at least traces its history back to the beginning days of Nellis Air Force Base. And now I would say it's really the home of the Air Force tactician, leader, warrior kind of thing. So you could really expand it, but it is still the home of the fighter pilot. So with that said, we're going to kind of the way I want to talk about this episode is kind of lay out as a table setter what major events we're going to talk about or I'm going to be talking about over the next couple of months. And so we'll break this into very similar components of how the rest of this season will break it down. So what we're going to try to do here today and then over the next couple of months is answer that question, why Nellis? What makes it important? Second, we're going to talk about the history of the base, and I've broken that history into three distinct eras. For ease of memory, it's the post-Korean War era, the post-Vietnam era, and the modern era that we contend are still in today. And then the third part of this episode is we're going to talk about some of the important units and combat capabilities that reside at Nellis. There is virtually every combat capability of the United States Air Force is resident at Nellis or is a direct reporting unit in another location to Nellis. So that's how we're going to get after this, Slam. So let's get right into part one, the introduction, why Nellis? Let me give you and the listeners just a brief history you already know this, but an airfield just about 10 miles north of Las Vegas was established in 1941 as Las Vegas Army Airfield. It was built as part of the massive expansion of the Army Air Corps and eventually Army Air Forces in 1940 and 41, just prior to and then right after we became involved in World War II. It was initially, and the lineage of the base is as a gunnery airfield. It was used for gunnery training at the time for a variety of bombers, including at the beginning of the conflict, B-17s, all of the bombers really throughout, and by 1945, B-29s, which really taken the fight to the Japanese in the summer of 1945, they were doing their training out at Nellis. So bomber crews would go to a couple of different locations, but Las Vegas Army Airfield was one of the major locations they went to for gunnery training. And that's kind of the soul of Nellis Air Force Base is gunnery training. So after a short demobilization period after the war, the airfield went away, came back in 1948 as Las Vegas Air Force Base right after the service had become independent in 1947. Again, it was a gunnery base, this now a fighter gunnery base. And what's really important, what I would contend is one of the most important single anniversaries that we should celebrate in the U.S. Air Force would be the establishment of the Aircraft Gunnery School in 1949. The Aircraft Gunnery School eventually becomes the Fighter Weapons School and now the U.S. Air Force Weapons School. I will make the argument over this period, and I think as a fellow graduate, you would probably agree with me, that it's the single most important institution of the United States Air Force. Last thing I'll say about the history, it's named after the airfield. It eventually had its name changed in 1950 to Nellis Air Force Base after Lieutenant William Nellis, a P-47 pilot in the European theater in World War II. He was shot down three times, that last one being fatal. He was a Nevada resident, eventually moved in grammar school to the Las Vegas area. And so that's why it was named after him. So, Slam, anything on Nellis Air Force Base history that you think I missed before we got into why it's important?
It's hard to sum up Nellis Air Force Base history in the 3 to 4 minutes that you did. So to say that you didn't miss anything would be probably a silly thing to assert. Having said that, you're just setting the table getter. So I will bite my tongue till later in the episode.
All right.
Very well. Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the importance of the Air Force. There's a couple of sayings. One that I have heard a lot is, as goes Nellis, so goes the Air Force. At least when we used to go there, it was called the Tactical Center of Excellence. A phrase that I like to use is something that I learned at Quantico when I did a year of school with the Marines, and they talk about Quantico as the beating heart of the Marine Corps. And I thought, man, that is perfect for Nellis, because Nellis, I believe, is really the beating heart of the Air Force. There's tests, there's training, there's tactics development, the Tactical Center of Excellence at the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, the best exercise that really the world does in the air domain. So with those kinds of things, what is it that you think makes Nellis so important? Why is it necessary to do some episodes on this one single Air Force base? There's other Air Force bases that are important, like Langley, but we're not going to be doing a whole season on Langley. What is it about the Nellis Air Force Base that is important?
Two words: integration and realism. That is to say, integration between different capabilities, integration not just across the Air Force in terms of the different core competencies and mission capabilities of the Air Force, but across the Joint Force and across many of our allies and partners around the world that come to Nellis and the associated ranges every year to train and make ourselves more capable and lethal in the application of air operations. Beyond the integration piece, there is something really, really special just about being able to train with all of your mission partners in a very dynamic and realistic environment. So that is having threat simulators out there that are relatively similar to the threats we might face in combat. And you can't do that oftentimes in garrison, whether it be because of airspace restrictions, training or safety restrictions, other restrictions. And to the max extent possible, Nellis Air Force Base and Nellis Ranges allows for realistic training in a very integrated fashion across multiple domains. So we're not just, while the air domain is what we're focusing on here, when you go out to Nellis Air Force Base, we are at least notionally thinking about ways to integrate different domains into joint operations. And it's just a very realistic place to do training that you don't find really anywhere else in the world on a similar scale.
Absolutely. And you talked about joint. It's a lot of joint as well as coalition. And so we bring coalition partners out for Red Flag, for other events. But if we train like we fight as a joint force and a combined force. So certainly the Commonwealth nations are very familiar with Nellis Air Force Base. They send folks out and train with us. And of course, the joint partners spend a lot of time at Nellis as well. I think you absolutely nailed it on the integration and realism. And as you mentioned, it's kind of unparalleled around the world. I think you can make a pretty strong argument this is the most important Air Force base in the world. And I think it wouldn't even be a stretch to say it is one of the most important military installations in the world. And certainly when you're out there for like a Red Flag exercise and you see the whatever they quote it, the fifth or sixth largest Air Force in the world on the Nellis ramp at the time. You look at all that combat power and all the different capabilities out there. It's just a wild thing. And as a super cheesy air-minded guy, I love to go out on night and go watch night takeoffs for a red flag exercise. And you see, you know, B-2s taking off, you see Raptors taking off, you see an AWACS lumbering down the strip. I mean, it is pretty amazing to go see all of that combat capability there. So
you mentioned earlier the home of the fighter pilot. While it's way beyond that, I'm glad it still says that on the sign when you drive into Nellis Air Force Base.
And a little bit of history there that was taken away for a little while and brought back. And I think it's important. So there's reasons why you'd maybe want to take it away. You don't want it to just seem like this is only a base for fighter pilots, but there's something about the ethos of Nellis that needs that sign back. And it was celebrated quite a bit when it came back. And I don't even remember the 2010 to 2012 timeframe.
No, that's a great point. I was not going to explicitly say that, but I certainly wanted to allude to that in my comments. That is to say,
well, the person that took it down is not one of my listeners. So don't worry about it.
You don't say. Yeah. No, I'm not a fighter pilot. But when I was, a young CGO, I remember vividly one of my Intel instructors and mentors, and this is, you know, he didn't create it, obviously. This is a very common thing, but it was like, hey, if the blood of the fighter pilot doesn't flow through your veins, it will be on your hands. And that was basically telling young Intel officers who work at the squadron level, work your ass off when you're studying the threat, because you are giving information to these men and women that are going to help them stay alive and also execute their mission effectively. And you can, I think, extrapolate that message to home of the fighter pilot for any airman or warrior that rolls into Nellis and is interested in joint operations, right? Home of the fighter pilot is the important historical foundation of Nellis Air Force Base. And if that offends someone who isn't a fighter pilot who rolls in there, then man, you don't appreciate history would be my input there, right? Mm-hmm. Just because you're not quote unquote a fighter pilot doesn't mean you can't embrace the fighter pilot ethos and the fighter pilot history that Nellis Air Force Base and the U.S. Air Force have. And that's what I think is so important about that message, not just a freaking message on a sign, but it's about a work ethic and an ethos going forward that we're going to work hard, we're going to play hard, we're going to focus on mission effectiveness and dominating the adversary. And Nellis Air Force Base and Nellis Range allows us to do that more than, as you alluded to, Getter, really any other Air Force base or military complex, I think anywhere in the world, quite frankly.
All right, Slam, I would like to think we made a pretty good argument for why Nellis is important. Let's look a little bit more at the history. And as we mentioned up front, neither you nor I are historians. We've read a lot about Nellis and the people that are important, the aircraft, the missions, et cetera. But we're not historians. I will have a historian on later. I know Dr. Lasley will be joining us. He is already a one-time guest of the podcast, and he can fix us to 100% if we get some of this wrong. But when I look at Nellis, I break it into what I think are three really important eras. And the first that I call the foundational era is kind of 1950-ish to, so really it's the end of Korea to sort of the beginning and really almost all the way through Vietnam until at least kind of linebacker. And that gets us into the second era, which I like to call the revolutionary era. And as I've already talked about, my absolute favorite part of Air Force history to talk about. And I break this one up in about 1973, really to the transition from Desert Shield to Desert Storm. And Nellis really revolutionizes the way the Air Force does business. And then the third, the modern era, is really an era of expansion. And really to get to what you talk about, it's a lot about the integration. So where in the second era, we get the realism, and we'll talk about that, then we get a lot more integration in the modern era. The weapons school increases in size. We bring in more countries, more joint partners, and Nellis becomes the center of joint and coalition air and space fighting, if you will. So With that said, let me give just a little bit of an intro, and Slam, interrupt me with anything. I'm sure at least in the second era, you'll have some things that you want to talk about. But the foundational era, there's not a lot that is actually written about the foundational era at Nellis, and I think it's actually ripe for a book. Somebody should definitely write a book about the Fighter Weapon School. It's something I keep threatening to do. Now I have a year out of command. I really should get on that. But the foundational era, to me, is driven by the people. And really what we're talking about is Korean fighter pilots who return to do aerial gunnery instruction at Nellis. And so the school is known as the Aircraft Gunnery School. And that is established in 1949. That is the legacy school to the U.S. Air Force Weapon School. It was established in 1949. So it's only 2 years younger than the Air Force itself. And there was air-to-air and air-to-ground gunnery that was done at the school, and it was a place to teach gunnery tactics. So in 1954, the school made what I think is not only a significant name change, but really the focus of the school went from just aircraft gunnery to actual fighting and the tactics of, at the time, fighter aircraft. And it's a lot of F-86, it's F-100, and then we get into the Century series. But 1954 is really the birth of Nellis as we know it with the Fighter Weapon School. And there's, I think the history, at least for me, comes down to two individuals that really pushed Nellis to the forefront. And the first is Frederick Boots Blessé, eventually retired as a two-star general. He was assigned at Nellis from 1952 to 1956, and he did a ton of stuff. He taught at the Aircraft Gunnery School. He was eventually a fighter weapons school instructor. He was a squadron commander of a tactical fighter squadron there. He wrote a tactics manual that was called No Guts, No Glory. And that is, at the heart of it, the ethos of the Korean era gunfighter fighter pilots. And this is actually, in the history of aerial combat, the first widely read tactics manual. So it's the first ever manual on fighter tactics. And at the time, it was classified, but eventually declassified. It was sent throughout the both the Air Force as well as our coalition partners and our joint partners. And a lot of people have read No Guts, No Glory and still have. And Boots was the first one to take kind of the old boy, you know, you can only learn how to fight in an aircraft by seeing it and flying it and doing it, to actually take the time to write down some of those tactics, put them on paper, and get that out to the community. And No Guts, No Glory was sent out through the Fighter Weapons School's newsletter, the Fighter Weapons newsletter, and that thing has been going on for as long as the school is there. And that was Boots is really the first person that really is driving Nellis to a greater import than just being a gunnery school. His importance to the Fighter Weapons School is still recognized by the fact that the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, their award for top instructor every year is the Boots Blessé Award. So that tells you something about how important he was as a Fighter Weapons School instructor. The second one is very well known, and we'll be doing an arc, maybe even a whole season, but certainly an arc on John Boyd. He was assigned in Nellis for 6 years, from 1954 to 1960. I will recommend Corum's book, Boyd. It is a little bit of hero worship. There are better books on John Boyd, but if you want a gateway drug on reading about John Boyd or the early days of the Air Force, and in particular Nellis Air Force Base, it's a page turner. Robert Corum can lay out a story, and Boyd is a great book to read. And then once you get a little bit more into it, picked up Franz Osinga's book. There's a couple of other really good Boyd books out there. The Mind of War is another good one. John Boyd, at least as Corum says, it becomes at this point the most famous fighter pilot in the world. And a lot of that is through a bet that he had. He called himself 42nd Boyd, or he was known as 42nd Boyd. And the bet was basically this. He would put up $20, a not insignificant amount in the mid-50s, to say he will start from a position of disadvantage in basic fighter maneuvers or dogfighting, and he could basically survive or kill the adversary that was attacking him within 40 seconds. And at least as Corum lays it out, he never had to pay out the bet of $20 of somebody being able to actually gun him. Even though he started a position of disadvantage, he was able to fight to at least a draw, if not win, every single time. That's That's a claim that some people disagree with, but the point was it was pretty well known throughout the Air Force that John Boyd was among the most talented fighter pilots in the service. He will eventually take a very scientific view at his way of flying and fighting and realize that there's a reason he's not just, he was kind of had God-given talent, but there was also more to it. There was physics behind it. And if he could teach it, if he could learn the physics of how to max perform his airplane, then others could as well. And that is the genesis of the second major manual on fighter tactics that he wrote. It was called the Aerial Attack Study. And this is by far, far and away the most advanced tactics manual. And it's still used by some countries today as their tactics manual. It was also classified. Eventually, they had to work really hard to get it declassified so that other people could read it. It's about 150 pages, and it's broken into offensive and defensive, and it lays out with pictures the maneuvers and not only what you can do against the adversary, but how you can respond to what the adversary does and how they can respond. So the moves, the countermeasures, the countermeasures, all of those things in the aerial attack study. And it is not just looking back at it that we talk about how important it was. When he left after 6 years of being assigned to Nellis, he was given the Legion of Merit as a captain, which for those of you familiar with military decorations, that is a medal far beyond what you would ever see for a captain. I'm not sure I've ever heard of that medal going to a captain. But this one particular document that he wrote was so revolutionary and so important to the Air Force as a whole that he was recognized for that. And it really started a very long and distinguished career in life for John Boyd. But he really pushed it forward. And by throughout really this period, as we start to get into Vietnam, Nellis is the home of the fighter pilot. It is the home of fighter tactics for all of the frontline fighter aircraft. Last thing I will say before I hand it off to you, if you're looking for books, Check Six, which is the autobiography by Boots Blissé and Boyd by Robert Corum, are good ones to get started. And then if you if you're interested in John Boyd, there's plenty of other books, and I'll put some more links to them in the notes here. Slammer, I just talked a lot about the foundational era, an era that I absolutely love about Nellis. What springs to you in reading about and thinking about this era of Nellis history?
John Boyd, I think, is a leader and a thinker that, because of his imperfections or some of the bad parts of his personality, that there are people in the Air Force that I think throw out the good. And I think it's important for us to celebrate the brilliance of this man, what he brought tactically to the Air Force and to the Joint Force. You alluded to Quantico as the beating heart of the Marine Corps, but I would love to hear how the Marine Corps appreciates Boyd as a strategist and a tactician, and how they embrace him in terms of his impact on the Joint Force. Very few people in the history of the U.S. Air Force have had the impact across warfighting across the world that John Boyd has. You can make an argument that no one has.
So if there's one thing I know from my social media interactions, it is that nothing is more controversial than talking about John Boyd. You have the John Boyd acolytes and you have the John Boyd haters. And this is why we're actually going to do multiple episodes to talk John Boyd, because he's a very complicated figure. There is a good argument that a lot of what happened in Desert Storm could be based off of some of the things that he said and pushed. And people like the vice president at the time and the secretary of the defense at the time talked about what Boyd said. So there's some pretty good arguments about how maneuver warfare on the ground could be traced to some of John Boyd's briefings. Some other people would say that he has been vastly overstated. He, as you mentioned, he's kind of a complicated or flawed character, not particularly well-liked. He retired as a colonel. And part of that is because he found a way to piss off his bosses and never made general officer. If you read Corum's book, he found his way on the opposite side of General Creech, who I'll talk about a little bit later, maybe as important to the tactical air forces as any general, and probably along with General Curtis LeMay, the single, those two general officers put their imprint on the Air Force more than any two officers after the founding, after the World War II era. So if you find yourself on the opposite side of Creech, big Air Force is probably going to weigh in against you. And John Boyd kind of was lost to the United States Air Force for quite a while, is not important. So you actually have the Marines adopted Boyd's thinking and his thoughts on war much more than the Air Force did. And as a point to kind of bring that home, his papers, his family actually had his all of his papers and all of his historical documents, his entire library and books. Those are kept at the Marine Corps library and archives at Quantico and not with the Air Force. And I think that is definitely shows how the Air Force kind of turned its back on John Boyd. It started to come back a little bit, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But you make a good point in that John Boyd has really put his imprint on the Air Force, and he first puts his imprint on the Air Force in this era out at Nellis through not just being the best pilot out there, and but also the way that he looked at war fighting in an aircraft from a more cerebral point of view, and then trying to get that written down. And really, when we talk a lot about Nellis, it's not just about being the hotshot fighter pilot. There is some of that, but it is also built into the DNA at Nellis is kind of the ethos of the weapons school, which is build, teach, and lead. It is to not only be the smartest guy or gal in the room, but to build the smartest guy or gal in the room. And John Boyd is one of those that starts to push that. Not just I can be great in the aircraft, but I can find a way to make other people great in the aircraft. And especially as we start to get into this next era of Nellis history, that I think becomes just totally ingrained, which is let's bring a realistic training scenario. Let's build that up. Let's bring everybody in here so that they're going to be better in combat and more able to survive and be lethal in whatever their combat capability is through what we're able to teach them here. So I think Boyd, we need to look just beyond him being a great fighter pilot, but to look at him as starting to really build in the core of an instructor into what we do at Nellis. So I really think both Blasé and Boyd are incredibly important during this era to build what Nellis becomes.
Yeah, and Gitter, if I may, the CEO of the firm in which my wife and I get our financial analysis is a huge John Boyd guy. Never served a day in his life in the military, and his reason for adoring Boyd is appreciation for observe, orient, decide, and act, in his case, in the context of the financial world. But it shows how much Boyd's thought and influence has shaped the world well beyond military personalities. So he's a big fan of what he calls, you know, the mad major. Obviously Boyd progressed beyond then, but his influence well beyond military personnel is extraordinary. In fact, just in the last week, while I know you hate this quote, I hate this quote, Gitter, I've got to use it. Matt Campbell, the head football coach at Iowa State, was asked when he didn't leave the Iowa State Cyclones, you know, Matt, why didn't you leave Iowa State? You have so many other job opportunities as an exceptional football coach. And he said, I didn't get into this profession to be somebody. I got into this profession to do something. Now, John Boyd, of course, famously said, you can either be somebody or do something. I think it's a wildly problematic quote. My point for bringing it up, though, is to show the influence that John Boyd and his thought process had on American culture and the way senior leaders across a variety of different career fields are influenced by John Boyd.
So the other thing I'll say is just to kind of put a halt on the Boyd conversation, because we could really spend the rest of the episode talking about John Boyd. I did mention that there are some other books besides Quorums. I wanted to at least bring those two up. The first, which I think is a much better biography, is actually from a guy at Maxwell Air Force Base who taught with Boyd when Boyd would come in and teach and give lectures, is The Mind of War by Grant Hammond, who is still an instructor at the, I believe, the Air War College. So I think that one is excellent. And then to dig deep into his actual theories, which he never wrote down, he only did them in briefs, I think there is no better book than Science, Strategy, and War, The Strategic Theory of John Boyd by Franz Ozinga. Those two books, so if Quorum brings you in, those are the two books that you need to pick up to really understand Boyd. Okay, I hate to stop the conversation on Boyd, their slammer, but we will not be able to get out of that that wormhole if we just keep talking about Boyd. I think it's safe to say that we've talked a little bit about the foundational era and how Nellis at this point is starting to become that tactical center of excellence as well as that center of instructional excellence. But there actually starts to become some stasis at the end of this era and into Vietnam. And actually, I think you can make the argument that in particular, the Fighter Weapons School did not serve the U.S. Air Force very well in Vietnam. And part of that is that the thinking, so when you had Blasé and Boyd were driving thinking and tactics development for a while, that stopped actually happening. And there didn't seem to be a whole lot of development that was going on. And just as an example, the Fighter Weapons School, Nellis was still teaching Korean tactics as we got into Vietnam, the welded wing, things like that. And the Air Force had some pretty low kill ratios and were losing far too many aircraft. Both the Air Force and the Navy did looks at why this was happening. The Navy stood up their own, the little brother of the Air Force Weapons School, Top Gun, and they were able to start teaching those new tactics. And I would contend, as much as I hate to admit it, I would say that Top Gun outperformed the Fighter Weapons School, certainly at the end of the Korean War. But that kind of disappointing performance of the Air Force writ large and really the Fighter Weapons School in particular is, I think, the key to understanding why Nellis becomes so important prior to Desert Storm. So this era, as I've talked about, is, I think, my favorite and most important era to talk about in Air Force history. Between about 73 to January of 1991, the Air Force, or the Nellis, is the epicenter of a revolution in tactics, training, development, etc. And it really is driven by a lot of pissed off veterans that come back from Vietnam and say, I wasn't trained, I was ill prepared, and it was downright dangerous what you threw me into in Vietnam by not preparing me with it, not realistic training, not enough hours, not a good enough understanding of the adversary, and too many good men and women didn't come home from Vietnam because they were so poorly trained. So what you get is a bunch of pissed off veterans who found a way to survive and who learned hard lessons in the skies over Vietnam. And they are determined to never allow another Air Force member to go into combat as ill prepared as they were. And then we get people that are at least minor celebrities, absolute legends in our business, that were all there at about the same time. About the mid 70s, there is an explosion of tactics and training development in terms of realism, et cetera. So there's a couple of things that I think are really important and that I like to talk about. The first, the Fighter Weapons School, really didn't serve the Air Force very well. They are completely revitalized, in particular around the F4 division. And there is what I think is an absolute murderer's row of majors that are there between the about 74 to 76 timeframe. Many of them who go on to great success in their careers, majors at the time, John Jumper, Dick Myers, Ron Keyes. Dick Myers eventually becomes a chairman of the Joint Chiefs. John Jumper becomes a commander of Air Combat Command, and then eventually the chief of staff of the Air Force. And Ron Keyes also becomes a COMAC, or commander of Air Combat Command. They all taught in the F4 Weapons School at the same time, and they were driving new ways to train fighter pilots. And they built something called the building block approach that is used to this day at the Fighter Weapons School. But that's just one program. So you've got the Fighter Weapons School that is pushing new training, working on the tactics, saying we need to get away from things like welded wing. We need to go to things like the fluid four. We need to take advantage of all of the killing power of everybody, regardless of how young and inexperienced your wingman is. That wingman is still a shooter, right? So they start to develop this. But that training in and of itself is not good enough if you don't have a realistic scenario to train against. And there are three major programs that build on realism. The first would be the use of what eventually becomes known as the aggressors. And like I mentioned, it's the Iron Majors. It's a bunch of relatively junior officers that are pushing this. The aggressors were started by Major Randy O'Neill in 1972. And the thinking here was pretty similar. Aircraft did not get the opportunity to train against, or our fighter pilots didn't get the opportunity to train against dissimilar aircraft. So F4 would train against other F4s, F5s against other F5s, et cetera. And there needed to be an era or an area where these air crew could get an opportunity to train against dissimilar aircraft. So DACT, dissimilar aircraft training, or DACT, was the heart of the aggressors. And the thought was, let's have an aircraft that mimics what we will see in the skies over Vietnam. It just so happened the T-38 trainer, eventually known as the F-5, mimicked the MiG-21, which was a pretty deadly aircraft in Vietnam at the time. So Neil pushed the idea, and there were some senior officers that helped push it along the way. But eventually in 1972, approval was given for the establishment of the 64th Aggressor Squadron, at the time outfitted with T-38. So we're going to have a whole episode on the history as well as current day aggressors. But that was really the start, is we need to have a dedicated professional adversary force who learns about the adversary, trains like them, and provides a more realistic look to our fighter pilots. The next major realism initiative is Operation Red Flag. And this was driven by Major Moody Suter. In 1975 was the first exercise of Operation Red Flag. And the theory here was pretty simple. If you look at the numbers, most air crew that died in Vietnam died in their first 10 combat missions. They were inexperienced. They weren't ready for what they were and weren't trained for what they were going to see in the skies over Vietnam. The thinking here was pretty simple. Well, if the first 10 are the deadly sorties, let's have the first 10 combat sorties over the skies of Nevada, as opposed to the skies of Vietnam or wherever the next fight would be. So the thought was, let's have as realistic a training exercise as possible, and let's get our youngest pilots their first 10 combat sorties in Operation Red Flag. And from a relatively small start, the Air Force acquired adversary capabilities and weapon systems, put them out on the range, developed things that would mimic that. You had the aggressors that would fly there. And what you started to present was a realistic scenario to the pilots, so they would get those first 10 combat missions. The last of the realism initiatives that I'll talk about is the Red Eagles, sometimes known as America's MiG Squadron. This was driven by Major and then Lieutenant Colonel Evil Peck, a couple of others. But the thought here was, the aggressors are good because they mimic the aircraft and the tactics of the adversary. But wouldn't it be even better to actually fly against the real thing? Steve Davies' book, Red Eagles, is the absolute best book. It is an absolute page turner. I highly, highly recommend it. Just did a reread of it last year, and it's so good. It really stands up. But it talks about what for a very long time was a highly classified program where the U.S., through various means, acquired Soviet-built fighter aircraft and flew them out of the Tonopah Test Range, which is out on the Nevada Test and Training Range, or Nellis Range, if you will. And our pilots, as well as some other joint pilots, got the opportunity to fly against the real thing, to fly against MiG-17s, MiG-21s, eventually MiG-23s. And the thought here is, let's get rid of the buck fever that a pilot gets when they see an adversary for the first time. You don't want them thinking, oh my God, a MiG-21. You want them thinking, how am I going to kill this thing? So Slam, we talked fighter weapons school. We talked the aggressors. We talked Red Flag and Red Eagles. What say you on these?
Red Eagles is literally the only book I've read three times. I've only read a couple twice. It is that much of a page turner. So I assume everyone listening to the podcast is a fan of aviation and air power history. If you haven't read it once, or you don't own the book, you need to buy it and read it. I would say that first. So in the post-Vietnam era, it wasn't just that we were in an American malaise of, my God, we more or less lost in Vietnam. We were intimidated by a very powerful adversary in the Soviet Union, and Nellis Air Force Base was an important part in strengthening our military and giving us the confidence to bow up to a very powerful aggressor in the Soviet Union. One big aspect of that, from a doctrinal standpoint, was what in the Air Force we call centralized control and decentralized execution, as trusting our pilots and our warfighters to go out and, with a relatively modest amount of guidance, go out and execute and fight and kill in a tactical environment. The Soviet Union and the communist militaries at the time didn't necessarily trust their warriors, I would argue, and they had a very centralized approach to military warfare. And ultimately, Red Flag was about training and trusting our pilots and our war fighters to go out and execute with very broad tactical objectives And that's a big part of Nellis's heritage, is that we just said, hey, you need to go execute X, Y, and Z, go do it as a flight lead. And ultimately, the Nellis Range and Nellis Air Force Base provided a forum for our pilots and our air crews to go ahead and do that. One other thing I would mention, Gitter, is the 1970s and 1980s were a very depressing and at times controversial time in American history and military history. There was rampant drug use across all the services, and we needed venues where military members and war fighters go out and basically show that, my God, I know what I'm doing. I'm ready for the adversary. And it was, again, a very depressing and sad part of American military history. We don't talk about it a lot. We ignore this period in American military history. Vets that served in the 70s and 80s will occasionally come up to me and be like, yeah, I served for 4 years or 8 years, but it was an era that didn't matter. And it actually makes me really sad. Nellis Air Force Base in the 1970s, 80s, up until Desert Storm, I think, were part of resurrecting the joint force and actually making our country a bit more capable militarily. We don't talk about this period in American history, really, I would argue from 1968 to 1990 was really pretty sad. And Nellis was a period of time, or Nellis created a period of time where we could actually train air crew members and pilots to compete with an adversary in a way that hadn't been done before. And that's something I think that we need to really emphasize throughout the 10 or 11 episodes of this series.
A lot there. And I think what you're talking about and kind of the revitalization, if you will, of the Air Force and really the military as a whole, we see the evidence of it in 1991. And I am a little hesitant on kind of the revisionist history, as we talked about, of Desert Storm. Just, you know, we beat up on a weakling, as you and I already talked about in the previous episodes. When we talk Desert Storm, is I think that is not good revisionist history. I think that is minimizing what we actually did. They were flying frontline fighters. They had frontline Soviet equipment. They had the fifth largest army, the sixth largest air force in the world. We were trained to the Soviet Union threat, and we probably would have done very well against them, but we absolutely annihilated Iraq. That's incredibly important. I think the fact that Russia and China have gone to school on what we did in 1991 shows that especially the air campaign revolutionized warfare. And I don't think that is a stretch to say that the Desert Storm air campaign absolutely revolutionized the way wars are fought. And I think that can be directly tied to Nellis Air Force Base. Sorry, Sam, go ahead.
No, absolutely. And didn't just revolutionize how air campaigns are fought. And I think you were alluding to this for the American Air Force, the American military. It changed how Russia, China, a variety of middle powers approach air combat and joint operations going forward. And that can't be overstated.
There's a lot here. I love this era to talk about. I think what's really key is not any one of these events or programs or initiatives is necessarily more important than the others. They all were working together in this period to build that air force, that joint and coalition air power that was so successful in Desert Storm. And I think you need to take them all together, the Fighter Weapons School, Red Flag, the Aggressors, and the Red Eagles. And then another key component is it's not just tactics and training and doctrine that is improving. You also are getting some significant improvements in the equipment. Also at Nellis-ish, you get the F-117s up the road at Tonopah Test Range, which is where the Red Eagles were flying as well. You're getting the first operational stealth aircraft, which was pretty darn successful in Desert Storm. If you want to talk about that or listen to that, I'd send you to the 3-episode arc on Desert Storm. We talk quite a bit about F-117s. But there's also going on at during this time, a study at Nellis, the ACE-Vol, AIM-Vol study, which when I had Dr. Lasley on here, he was able to say what they stood for. I have no idea, but it was to look at every single air-to-air engagement in Vietnam. We learned a couple of things, and one of them was that the missiles sucked. So we started getting new air-to-air missiles, improved versions of the AIM-7 radar-guided missile, and then the AIM-9 infrared-guided missile, and eventually the AIM-120 active radar-guided missile. But in addition to those, you get air-to-ground weapons. We're just starting to see them in the linebackers at the end of the Vietnam War. But now, in addition to LG laser-guided bombs, you're also starting to eventually get some other types of precision munitions. So you start to get precision-guided munitions. And then, of course, the aircraft. And there are some beautiful aircraft that are designed during this period and are still flying. God's jet, the mighty, mighty, the F-15, later the F-16 and the A-10, all are developed at this time. They're all going through early operational tests at Nellis. They're all flying very quickly before even they're in an operational status. They're flying at red flag, and they're testing out how we would train and employ these new aircraft. What you really get is Nellis as the epicenter for everything that's going on, the new equipment, the new tactics, the new training. Everything is happening at Nellis. And I think what General Horner, General Chuck Horner, is the Combined Air Forces Air Component Commander in Desert Storm is fighting with, is a force that was forged at Nellis Air Force Base and the Nevada Test and Training Range. The last thing that I would say here is just I love to promote some books that I really enjoy. And we kind of already mentioned, first off, Red Eagles by Steve Davies. Sierra Hotel by a former fighter weapons school instructor during this era, and eventually the Air Force historian, C.R. Andrig, is excellent. I love Sierra Hotel, talks about the people that are responsible for these efforts. Dr. Lasley's The Air Force Way of War focuses on primarily red flag, but goes over all of this and what drove this training. It is really, or this revolution in tactics and realistic training. I think his is a great study of all of them. So I would highly recommend Lasley's book, Tiger Check by Munch Fino, talking about what the air crew were training to at the time and how their training was revolutionized during this era. And then something that we don't often talk about is the general officers that were the protectors of these Iron Majors. You know, you read Corum's book, and Generals Dixon and Creech don't come off too well, but you don't, in a bureaucratic organization like the United States Air Force or something like the United States military, majors don't get things done unless people with stars on their shoulders are protecting them and making things happen. And the two commanders of Tactical Air Command at the time, first General Dixon and then General Creech, they were protecting these individuals. They were protecting these initiatives and making sure that they were codified and that they lived on. And I think a really good book to read on Creech's impact. Yep. Creech Blue by Lieutenant Colonel, now Lieutenant General James Slife. And then talking about the F-117, I don't think you can beat Skunk Works by Ben Rich, but Stealth by Peter Westwood, which just recently came out, is also excellent. So a ton of great books there. And Slammer, you were one of the causes of me reading a bunch of these books, in particular Sierra Hotel. Anything that you want to bring up on this era before we kind of transition into the modern era?
For any of the young military personnel that might be listening, you know, like, oh, where do I start? First, Boyd by Karam. I mean, acknowledge he's a bit of a fanboy, but you got to start there. I think it's important to read that.
It is.
Yes.
Get a little of that in your veins, and you're ready to read a little bit more.
It is crack. And then Dr. Lasley's The Air Force Way of War. For someone who had been exposed to Nellis, that was absolutely like mind-blowing and really enjoyable. I think even for folks who had even never been in Nellis Air Force Base, it's still a very, very useful read. But for young officers who might be going to Nellis for the first time, going out for an exercise, for a weapons school support, TDY, temporary duty exercise, it's still a very useful and powerful read. And for folks just interested in the history of Nellis Air Force Base, Dr. Lasley's, again, The Air Force Way of War, is extraordinarily useful and very entertaining read, quite frankly. The last thing I'll say that I think sometimes, because it's so easy to get focused on the tactical, understandably, when you're talking about Nellis, is it's part of the Soviet and American competition in the post-Vietnam era, you could argue in the post-World War II era, and that is to say, we trust and we trusted our pilots in a way to go out and execute in a way that the Soviet Union did not. And the Soviet Union, the Soviet Air Force, to this day still, I would argue the Russian Air Force, has a very centralized control approach to air power, and where they don't necessarily trust their pilots and their warfighters. And I think it's when you talk about Nellis Air Force Base and the comparison of American air power and Soviet or Russian air power, it's a celebration of the West, you know, the capital W, the West, and the United States in comparison to the Soviet Union and Russia. And it's a big reason that the United States was successful in winning the Cold War, I would argue. And it's a big reason why U.S. and Western air forces continue to have tactical and operational advantage over our adversaries that are trained or sort of adhere to Russian doctrine or Russian military perspectives writ large.
Hopefully we've gotten people interested in learning more about that era and reading more about that era, because it's just so good. So let's transition. So Desert Storm changes air warfare, changes really warfare. And then that ends up being, I would like to think, codified in this modern era. So I would take that as 91 on. And in recognition of the fact that Nellis is not just the home of the fighter pilot, so I don't think we get rid of that phrase from the lexicon, but I do think it's a lot more than that. Eventually, the Fighter Weapons School is renamed the U.S. Air Force Weapons School, and that is not just a nod to, you know, we've got to be politically correct here. It is really in recognition of the fact that the Fighter Weapons School is a lot more than the fighters that it was built upon. Even before Desert Storm, the school had already expanded beyond the fighter world to include command and control and intelligence, of which we are both graduates of. And then after Desert Storm, the Mobility Weapons School and the Bomber Weapons School get integrated into the Air Force Weapons School. And now you are getting really the whole gambit of Air Force combat capabilities. The Air Force Weapons School, I think the size and scope now has got to be shocking to some of the people that have long since retired during the days of the Fighter Weapons School era. I just looked at the fact sheet today, 19 squadrons at 9 locations, graduating more than 200 students every year and more than 30 officer and enlisted courses. Every fighter bomber platform that we have, special operations forces, combat search and rescue, space, cyber, intelligence, I already mentioned, high altitude platforms, MQ-9s, I mean, you name it. And I know I'm leaving out somebody's favorite platform. All of the bombers, all of the mobility aircraft, they're all there. And even if they're not at Nellis, they still fall under the guise of the weapons school, and they all come together. And the weapons school truly has become the home of warfighting excellence and integration in the airspace and cyberspace domain. And I think that's really the key to this modern era, is that the fight is even just in the name, Fighter Weapons School, to the Air Force Weapons School. Because what you're seeing not only at the weapons school, but throughout Nellis, is that same kind of integration that you are getting at Red Flag. The aggressors are just part of it. Also during this era, we move just beyond live fly exercises to an LVCA live virtual and constructed environment, where we're bringing in things that are being done virtually as well to try and stress our war fighters. So I think that's the key to this era, is just the expansion of what Nellis does beyond more than just home of the fighter pilot. And so, Slam, we're both students of this era. We both grew up during this era. What do you think is important about Nellis in this modern era?
Outside of wartime, Nellis, its graduates, whether it be from the weapons school or some other training school, at the end of the day, Nellis Air Force Base is what prepares the Air Force and to a large extent the Joint Force to go to war, period. If we're not actually in combat, Nellis Air Force Base is effectively charged with getting the Air Force and our joint partners ready for combat. Just let that settle for a moment. We might go 6, 8, 10 years without a conventional conflict. Of course, we're going to have counterinsurgency and counterterrorism operations. We again, may go 10, 20, 30 years without a quote-unquote proper conventional war. And Nellis Air Force Base, the 57th Wing, the Weapons School, are effectively charged with ensuring that American air power is ready for the next conflict. That is an awesome responsibility. And that's how I sort of think about the importance of Nellis Air Force Base and the organizations that reside in Nellis Air Force Base. It is really, again, an awesome responsibility. And those of us that are graduates, whether it be of weapons school or other experiences, whether it be just someone who went to Red Flag once or twice, the Nellis experience should be something that prepares you for war against a major adversary. And it's, again, it's a daunting and really imposing sort of responsibility. But without, imagine Nellis and the Nellis range weren't there. Where would the Air Force be today? Where would the Joint Force be today? That's a rhetorical question. It's like, it's hard to fathom. If you let's say the Air Force is what it is, but without everything at Nellis, then how much more capable are we? It's hard not to swear, Gitter.
we would be. I don't think I was going to say we'd be nowhere. We certainly wouldn't. But all of the developments that have happened through test training, tactics development, and Nellis are critical to what we do. The integration that happens only at Nellis happens nowhere else. It's not going to happen at Maxwell Air Force Base. It's not even going to happen at Langley Air Force Base. It only happens at Nellis. And I don't want to give away too much. In part three, we're going to be talking about key components of Nellis. And I think that wonderful piece of land north of Las Vegas that is kind of the canvas where all of this is you know, drawn out, the Nevada Test and Training Range, is critical to what we do. But having a place for all of this to go out to test, to work things out, and to develop what the force does, I think is vitally important. And so imagining a world without Nellis, I can't. You know, imagine a world, even an Air Force, without weapons school graduates. You're going to lose most of your four-star generals, right? And five of the last seven chiefs of staff of the Air Force. Imagine the kind of training that happens at places other than Red Flag. It's good, but it's nowhere in comparison to what you get at Red Flag. So we're going to spend actually the next two episodes are really going to talk about the modern era. We got a couple of operators who spent the better part of a decade out at Nellis that are going to talk about why it's special. And then I'm really excited about the third episode in this, where we're going to actually have the 57th Wing Commander, who's in charge of all of this stuff, Brigadier General Michael Drowley, will be coming on, which over the next two episodes, we're going to spend a lot of time on the modern era. So we'll give it a little bit of short conversation here, but I think that is just to kind of whet the appetite for the next two episodes. And the last thing that I wanted to talk to you about, Slam, is we've talked about the history, and that's kind of where some of the episodes early in the season are going to be. And then we're going to get into the things, the components of Nellis, and talk a little bit. You know, we'll have an episode on the aggressors. We'll have an episode on the Thunderbirds. We'll have a couple episodes on Fighter Weapons School and U.S. Air Force Weapons School. But I wanted to talk about some of those. And I wanted to tee up the first one because I know you think that this is a national treasure, what is sometimes known as the Nellis Range, the Nevada Test and Training Range, or NTTR, or NITR if you absolutely have to. But please don't call it NITR. Just get that out of your vocabulary because I hate that term. But anyways, the Nevada Test and Training Range, or NTTR. Slammer, why is the NTTR important, or the Nellis Range important?
Oh, dude. Where do I start? You talk about the importance of realistic training. We started off this episode talking about the importance of realism and integration, but in this case, let's focus on realism. And that is to say, if you can fly onto a patch of land over, you know, several thousand square miles with simulators that are going to replicate relatively a robust threat laydown. We're going to talk about the aggressors, and you already alluded to Evil Peck and not just people replicating Russian or adversary fighters, but actually flying adversary or Russian fighters out there in the airspace. And the more you can make the threat environment realistic and relevant, the more capable your pilots and your warfighters will be. And that doesn't mean people just in the airspace. That means your controllers on the ground, your intel professionals on the ground. Everybody is going to benefit from a realistic threat environment. The Nellis test and training range is, again, a national treasure. One, in part, just its sheer size, the capability of the systems that we have across that range, and the fact that everybody's linked in. Everybody is able to go up, fly, have a shared picture in terms of, hey, what are we doing? We can go up and see, what did I do right? What did I do wrong? I would submit to you, Gutter, that the most important difference between the United States Air Force and any other Air Force in the world, you can argue capabilities, of course, as most of our friends would say, but beyond capabilities, it is debrief. That is to say, when we go up and we train or we go fight for real, what differentiates, I would submit, the American military, or at least the American Air Force, from some of our allies and some of our partners, is our willingness to hold each other accountable. The ability to debrief each other, say what I did right, what I did wrong, what I can do better the next time, is a huge part of the U.S. Air Force and U.S. military. And I truly believe makes us the greatest Air Force and the greatest Air Force from a joint perspective across the board in the world, is the ability to honestly debrief each other. And the knitter, I know you hate a getter, but the knitter provides a very good and realistic battle space to go ahead and train, fight, quote unquote, and then debrief at the end of the day. And then you build those relationships over time. And there's nothing like the Nellis debrief experience. I will tell this one story and then I'll shut up for the rest of the episode. As a weapons undergraduate, I was a supportive asset for a fighter pilot doing a basic fighter maneuver event. He flew for 24 minutes. He landed. The debrief took 7 hours. And it was an extraordinary experience. I had the opportunity to brief him, to step brief him, to debrief him, to be there for the entire critique from his instructors, and then to debrief him again. He flew for 24 minutes. That whole process took about 14 hours. You can't replicate that whole experience anywhere else other than the Nellis Air Force Base. If that happens anywhere else in the world, I'd like to know. And with that, I'll turn it over to you.
I didn't have that in my notes, but that is a great thing to talk about, the debrief. And up there, the 433rd, which is the F-15 and F-22 squadron at the Air Force Weapons School, they have a phrase: if there is a doubt, there is no doubt. If there is any doubt as to whether the student has passed the mission, there's no doubt they didn't pass the ride. They hold the line. They hold their students to account, and it makes you better. When you're going on to hour 6 or 7 of that BFM debrief, it is brutal, but you are learning so much every time. And it's kind of bred into what we do. You know, I just gave up command on Monday, which is why I'm sporting this beard right now. In the last week, we did a lot of debrief, talking about what went right, but we spent a lot more time on what went wrong, and what we can hand off to the next team. And I think it's really important. You need to look with a critical eye at how you've done and what you can do better. No pilot has ever flown a perfect sortie. No commander has ever had a perfect command tour. And whatever your combat capability is, you probably have not done it perfectly. And you can learn a little bit from studying the successes, but you can learn a lot from studying when you were not successful. And that's how you get better. In everything that we talked about in kind of the second era of improving the tactics and the training, that is kind of underpinned by the debrief, the realistic and open and honest debrief with rank doesn't count. And even Simon Sinek in, I believe it's Start With Why, talks about then Lieutenant Colonel Laurie Robinson debriefing Brigadier General at the time, John Jumper, about a mistake that he made. Both relatively famous 4 stars, General Jumper going on to be the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Robinson becoming the first female combatant commander when she commanded Northern Command. But I love that when he starts a book, I mean, a fairly famous writer is talking about the debrief that happens at Nellis and how in a room where rank isn't important, what matters is your performance and how we talk about that performance. I think it's a powerful message that I certainly wasn't planning on talking about, but you make an excellent point. So we talked a lot about the NTTR. We've talked a ton about, so I'm not going to spend more time because we're going to have a couple episodes on the Air Force Weapons School. We're going to have a whole episode on Red Flag. I think we spent a lot of time talking about how those are important. But I want to talk about some of the other capabilities that we didn't spend a lot of time about. We mentioned the aggressors. And when we think of the aggressors right now, we think a lot about the 64th aggressors, which fly the F-16s. For a while, we had the 65th aggressors that flew the F-15s. And boy, we missed those things. Seeing the blue painted eagle was pretty awesome. But the aggressors are more than just the F-16s. There's actually aggressors across multiple domains. There's space aggressors, there's cyber aggressors, and all of them are being fed by the 547th Intelligence Squadron. And together, they create the adversary tactics component of what happens at Nellis. So you've got the intelligence that kind of feeds everything that happens with the aggressors, so they act as a realistic adversary in all domains. And I don't think they're talked about a lot. In a couple of books, you'll read about the petting zoo. It's still a great, if you happen to be on Nellis Air Force Base and you're on the main drag and you see the beautiful Thunderbirds hangar and then the weapons school campus, if you keep heading south towards the strip, eventually you'll get to the threat training facility. You'll see a MiG-17 out front. Usually the SA-8 is parked out up front and you go in the back of the threat training facility. You see a bunch of radars, a bunch of surface-to-air missiles. You go inside, you got a MiG-21, a MiG-23, and a MiG-29. Actually, I don't think the MiG-21's there. I think it's in front of the 64. But nonetheless,
you get her.
Yeah.
Normally I wouldn't interrupt, but in this case I would. For those military members or veterans, if you're in Las Vegas or you're thinking about making a trip to Las Vegas, go to Las Vegas, go to Nellis, and you go to the TTF. And it's now a big portion of it. Most of it is unclass, right? And you can go see that. And we can arrange, you talk to the Air Mind podcast, get her, I'm going to sign you up, right? So if you're a big fan of this podcast, I'm sure we can arrange for a special tour from someone who's really smart to make sure you can talk to the various weapon systems. But for the people that are listening to this podcast, man, going to Nellis Air Force Base is a special experience and the threat training facility. So sorry, Gitter, signed you up for that, but I thought it was important. Yeah.
Well, great. I just, now you're going to have to work with Amanda to get me to, be released to go out to Nellis whenever somebody wants a tour, which I'd be happy to do. But no, seeing the petting zoo or the TTF, the threat training facility, is awesome. You'll drive right by Boyd Hall, which we'll talk about some other time. But just to kind of finish off that point, I don't think they get enough credit, those other aggressors besides the 64th that provide all domain or multi-domain threats, and then the intelligence that underpins it, I think is really important. We also talk a lot about the tactics development. There is a unit that is on Nellis that now falls under the weapons school, the 561st Joint Tactics Squadron. They write down all of these great ideas that folks have and test and train upon, and they put that down into what we call our Air Force Tactics, Techniques, and Procedures, AFTTP 3-1. They write these down for threats for every aircraft that talks about and codifies how we actually employ these combat capabilities. It's a hugely important and often overlooked capability out at Nellis, and it is joint. It says it right there in the squadron name. So they actually do this for some of the other services as well. I think that is really important. And then my next two guests are going to be members, former members of the 422 Test and Evaluation Squadron. They do operational tests. So when a platform or new capability has been proven to be good to fly with or to operate with, it's gone through developmental tests, right? This widget is safe in the air. Now, how do we employ it? That's when it goes into the domain of the 422 Test and Evaluation Squadron. And they do amazing things, bringing the F-22 online, bringing the F-35 online. They continue to do upgrades and test new software, new hardware for all of our aircraft. I think the 422 is really important. So a lot of talk in there, Slammer, anything on either of those units or the aggressors that maybe I missed?
No, sir. I'm a big fan of all.
Yeah. One that I actually don't know a ton of Thunderbirds, but I think the Thunderbirds are, I don't think there's any question that they are the best recruiting tool that the United States Air Force has. Our ambassadors in blue, the Air Force Demonstration Squadron or the Thunderbirds, a very prominent place at Nellis. You see their gorgeous hangar when you drive down the main drag at Nellis. It is also, as long as Slam has signed you up to go do visit the TTF, the threat training facility, their hangar is open as well. And their hangar goes through some of the history of the Thunderbirds, both, you know, great highs. They've performed for tens of millions of people. And then also the horrible lows, in particular, you brought up the time the Diamond Formation flew a loop into the ground. It is a terrible, terrible story. But there's a lot of history with the Thunderbirds. And near the end of this season, we're going to have at least one former Thunderbird come on and talk about what a two-year tour on the Thunderbirds being the face of the Air Force really means. So I don't think you could tell the story of Nellis without talking the Thunderbirds. And I think really that's what I wanted to get to in part three, which is the Nellis story is not just Red Flag and Weapon School. It is a big part of that. The 561st, the 547th Intel Squadron, the Aggressors, the Test and Evaluation Squadron, and of course, the Thunderbirds. Slammer, what else did I miss?
Dude, this is a magical military installation. I think you hit it all. All I would say is for any air power aficionado who has not been out to Nellis, you know, put it on your bucket list. So you go in, when you drive into that gate as a veteran, you know, that you see the airplanes on a stick. It's like a who's who from a military air power perspective historically. And then when you drive down Tyndall Avenue at Nellis Air Force Base, you're going to see Raptors. You're going to see bombers. You're going to see really the greatest airplanes that have ever been a part of aerial combat. Holy cow. Nellis Air Force Base is as good as it gets. I can't overstate how excited I am as a listener for these next 10 episodes, Getter. And I am humbled, surprised, and pleased that you allowed me to be a small part of this for the sort of the intro episode. Thanks very much.
Well, I knew not many people love Nellis or love to talk about Nellis as much as I do. Maybe on the next episode, we can talk about how the genesis of your call sign came from Nellis Air Force Base, but we'll leave that one between you and I. it's been a ton of fun. It is a little bit daunting to think about how you're going to tackle this whole thing and what Nellis is. I think we showed how important Nellis is throughout its entire history, and how really the Air Force's history is really tied up in what happens at Nellis. And hopefully the listener will take away from this, as Nellis goes, so goes the Air Force, as the old saying goes. And Nellis is a lot more than just home of the fighter pilot. Slammer, I can't thank you enough. I really appreciate you coming on. And hopefully you'll enjoy listening to the rest of these episodes. And we'll see when we have you on a third time.
Well, that does it for this first episode of the Nellis season. Got to be honest with you, it was great getting back to the podcast. It was really great to be able to talk to Slam about Nellis, a place that means so much to both he and I, very influential in our careers. I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with Nellis Air Force Base, but I hope even those of you that have spent a lot of time there or are currently assigned there, that you learned a little something about the base that maybe you didn't know, and hopefully over the next couple of months you'll learn even more. And for those of you that are not familiar with Nellis, I hope that this is just will whet your appetite to learn a little bit more about what I think is the most important military installation probably in the United States Department of Defense. But with that said, let me just say thanks for listening. I know I haven't been around a lot, so I appreciate you coming back to the podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That way you'll know as soon as I drop the next episode in this season. If you are so inclined to help me out, please feel free to leave a 5-star review. I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at airmindedpodcast@gmail.com or interact with me on social media. I'm at airmindedpod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And especially with this season where there's a lot of room to add things or go into a deep dive on something, if there's something you really want to hear about Nellis and maybe we didn't cover it, I would love to hear from you. So either email me or interact with me on social media, and hopefully we can get in whatever you think is really exciting about Nellis into this season. Finally, let me just say the views expressed on this podcast are mine alone and do not reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, the Department of Defense, or the United States government. This is the Air-Minded Gorilla, Tyson Wetzel, signing off and saying thanks for tuning in.